whenever the sermon title was announced this morning, Are You a Christian? I think that most everyone went to the same place that I would immediately go to whenever you hear that title, and thought that this was most likely planned to be a lesson on the plan of salvation. And it's not. I want to go a different route with it. And maybe moving forward tonight, we should look at it from the perspective of, are you Christ-like? Do you live your life in the same way that Christ lived his? And those that are here tonight, I want to give a little bit of context for the lesson, because it's a very personal one for me. I did a lot of looking at Holden for this one. And those that are close to me and know me, that I go through phases where I'm all in on different ideas and self-help ideas and books and things like that. I'm a book nerd. I can't help it. Like, I should probably find another hobby. But I like to read. At one point in time, I was a big fan of, you know, John Gordon's One Word. And the concept was, for 1 year, you focused on one word and you spent 365 days improving that aspect of your life, whether it was belief, faith, finances, whatever it was, that's what you worked on. I'm a fan of the idea of the process. Anyone who follows college football has heard, you know, Nick Saban, the head coach at Alabama, talk about the process. And the idea behind it is if you strip away the emotion and the feeling from something, you're left to deal with facts. And that makes decision-making more clear. And right now, I'm big on the idea of self-awareness, knowing who you are, knowing why you are who you are, knowing what you're good at and what you're bad at. So to tie this in, what does this have to do with the lesson? What I did over the last week or so is I sat down and I got really honest with myself about who Holden Smith the Christian is. And some of it I was happy about, some of it not so happy about. And I wanted to share that. I wanted us to be able to go through that tonight and look at it together. And why is it important to be Christ-like? John 14:15 reads, "If you love me, keep my commandments." To know his commandments, we have to know Christ. And since God isn't a God of do as I say and not as I do, by keeping his commandments, we find ourselves being like him. And according to Matthew 25, not being like him will lead us to an eternity in hell, while being like him can lead us to an eternity in heaven. And the goal of tonight's lesson is to cause us to look at who we are, to look at ourselves. And I certainly don't want to step on anyone's toes tonight, but I do want you to know as we go through this, I stepped on my own. I got real honest with me. I got real honest with what I thought of how I was doing. I got real honest with myself, and I found myself disappointed in some areas. So tonight, if the lesson impacts you as we go through it, know that it impacted me as I worked on it. And tonight, if I say you, I mean we and me, because we're certainly in this together. And the other thing I wanted to do is to make sure that as we go through the points tonight, that every point has an example from the life of Christ in it. And we'll certainly touch on other figures in the Bible and other Bible stories, and we'll certainly bring some secular ideas into it as well and some secular examples into what we look at. But it was very important to me that we brought the life of Christ into the lesson. And the first thing we want to look at is, are we like Christ in our words? Very little, if anything, in this life is more important than our words. Our words can build up or they can tear down. Words have won hearts and words have started wars. They've caused change and they've caused chaos. Adam and Eve were tricked with words. There wasn't some great Trojan horse that got them. They were tricked with words. Peter's ability to use his words at times was great and at times was a little lacking. He said some stuff he might should have kept to himself, and because of that, he wound up betraying Christ and had to go away and weep bitterly because of it. His words also brought the first gospel sermon, which 3,000 people heard and were saved. Words can get us in so much trouble that it's almost like from the time we learn to speak, we start learning these cute little key phrases that get us away from the responsibility of our words. You know, we've heard boys will be boys, or it's just locker room talk, or it's a little white lie. It's never hurt anybody. It's almost like it's part of our DNA. Like, the second we learn how to talk, we learn how to make excuses for what we just said. And to illustrate the importance of words, I had a few quotes that I wanted us to look at. It says, "Because even the smallest of words can be the ones that hurt you or save you." In other words, words are, of course, the most powerful drug used by mankind. And the last one said, words are like eggs dropped from great heights. You can no more call them back than ignore the mess they leave when they fall. And sometimes with our words, it's what we say. What the impact is in what we say. And this one, I think everyone's heard this one. It's a quote from Martin Luther King. It says, I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. Powerful words from a man who used his words to make a difference. And think about what he said here. He said, I hope that one day, and I'm going to add a little bit to this one, but I hope that one day my children live in a country where it's not about what color they are. It's not about what they have. It's not about where they live. It's not about who their parents are. It's not about any of those things. It's about who they are. It's about who they are as people. It's about what they do. It's about the change and the impact that they make. It's in how they treat people. And it's amazing that this concept comes up in the 1960s in Dr. King's speech, because clearly it's got to be a new concept, except it's not. If you go back to Luke 10, chapter 10, verses 25 through 37, we find Jesus speaking similar words here. Here's where we find the parable of the Good Samaritan. And the summation of the story of the Good Samaritan is simply to be good to all people, regardless of where they come from, regardless of who they are. Be good to them. Treat them the way you want to be treated. Because we have to go back and look here that the way the Jews and the Samaritans would have felt about each other at this time is very bad. Like, they have very poor relationships here. So for him to use this example, he is certainly telling them that they need to look at who the person is, not where they come from, not their nationality, not their race, who the person is. Sometimes with our words, it's what we don't say. Sometimes remaining silent is our best option. Some hills aren't ours to charge up, and this one's one that took me a few years, and some days I still forget. Not everything's your fight. Not everything's your battle. Abraham Lincoln, obviously a central focus of the Civil War, is quoted as saying, better to remain silent and be thought a fool than to speak and to remove all doubt. And if you're curious where you may have found inspiration for this idea, you can check out Proverbs 17:28 whenever we're done tonight. But you think about this. This is a man who ultimately, because of his position in the Civil War, wound up giving his life as the leader of the nation. And what he's saying here is that sometimes it's better and it's easier on you just to be quiet. Sometimes it's not your time to talk. It's your time to listen. It's your time to learn. It's your time to take a step back and listen to what's happening and observe the situation. And then maybe it's your time to react. But if you don't know what to say, don't. And again, we find that this wisdom isn't lost on Jesus either. Matthew, the 27th chapter, verses 12 through 14, we find that Jesus didn't answer the accusations made against him before Pilate. Why? Why in this situation, in this moment, would he choose to stay silent? He had accepted his fate. He was the Messiah. He was born to save the world from its sins, and that was his lot in life. Nothing said to these people at this moment was going to change that. If all of his prayers in the garden didn't change it, nothing he's going to say here is going to change it. So why speak? Third thing I want us to look at with our words, and this one's a big one for all of us, is sometimes it's how you say it. I say all of us. This one's a big one for me. Sometimes it's how you say it. Your tone matters. I'm a little loud and a smidge sarcastic. And sometimes it gets me in trouble. It's just there I go again. You know, those, as soon as you learn how to talk, you make excuses. It's just, you know, it's just sort of my nature. But rightly or wrongly, it's something I have to work on. Jordan will sometimes go, why are you mad? And it's like, I'm not mad. I'm just talking. You're yelling. Oops. I didn't know I was yelling. I was just talking. Your verbiage matters. Your word choice matters. Your volume matters. The context of the conversation matters. All of these things are important to remember when we use our words. We're often backhanded with our compliments. How many of us are in the middle of an argument of going, I think you do a great job, but the compliment's useless at that point. Like, nobody, like, you could have said whatever you wanted to, and all they heard was but, and you're mad. Like, and that's just sort of the way it works. You know, oftentimes whenever it comes to our words, we can use the steak on the trash can approach with people. We're offering a great pearl of wisdom, but the delivery's so bad, they're not taking it. And again, we find our example in Jesus. In Mark 11, 16 through 18, we find Jesus angry with the way the temple is being used for the profit of others. But notice what he doesn't do here. He doesn't go too far. He doesn't say anything he can't repeat. He doesn't say anything he can't be proud of. He doesn't single anybody out and browbeat them. He makes his point, and he stops. He's done. He makes his point, and he's done. There's a great lesson in all of that for us. If you're a parent, leader, role model, coach, elder, preacher, boss, and you're in discipline mode, be like Jesus says right here. Make your point and move on. Chances are the person you're talking to knows what they did, and they already feel bad. Make your point. Move forward. The second thing that we need to examine to see if we're being Christ-like is our actions. Our actions are how we're known to other people. You know, one of the favorite sayings around here is, you may be the only Bible that some people ever read. And that happens through your actions. Do we take advantage of other people? Do we tell the truth? Do we look out for others? You know, Judas certainly looked out for number one. Judas will be remembered throughout all of eternity for one singular action. For all we know, before that, he was a great guy. Doesn't matter. In one moment, his actions are all that's going to be remembered about him. Ananias and Sapphira looked out for number one. James and John even caught themselves at one point in time asking about who was going to be the greatest in the kingdom. Obviously, they were able to recover from that and move forward. But at times, our actions speak volumes about where we're at. And the one thing I want us to think about in this point is, do our actions match our words? Because we've talked a lot about what we say, but more oftentimes than not, what we do to back up what we say is what's going to be important to people. You know, coaches deal with this one a lot. Players come to them and go, hey, coach, I want to play. Like, what have I got to do to get more playing time? What have I got to do to get in the game? And then their actions say, but I don't want to get to practice early, and I don't want to stay late, and I don't want to run any extra, and I don't want to lift weights. Their actions and their words don't match up. With their mouth, they want to play. Whenever it's time to put out effort, it's not going to happen. And I think sometimes we fall into that trap, whether it's at work or, more importantly, whether it's in our Christian walk. We want to be better Christians. We want the building to be full. But I got to study with people. Like, I got to study myself. I've got to be here, like, more often. I've got to pray, like, and then we kind of become like the guy who wants to get off the bench and wants to play, but, like, the effort and the work and the stuff like that catches up with us. And you know, in James 2, it talks about how faith and works aren't mutually exclusive. Like, you can't have faith and works and then be opposite ends of the spectrum. They work together. You show one by showing the other. And the thing is whenever we go back to our example here, Jesus shows us that his actions and his words matched up perfectly. Like, they matched up amazingly well. And what I didn't do here was give exact scriptures, but if you go through the Gospels and start looking at the last couple chapters of each Gospel, you'll see the sincerity in Jesus' words through his actions. In the garden, he knew what he was about to go through, and he did it anyway. Before Pilate, he knew what was still in front of him, and he did it anyway. When he was struck and spat on, when he was beaten, when they placed the crown of thorns on his head, and ultimately they crucified him, in each one of those moments, he knew what was still in front of him. And he does it anyway, because his word said, I came here to save you. And his actions said it too. The sincerity in his words were backed up by his actions. Third point, final point, is our surroundings. And Sean talked about this one a little this morning. Fortunately, he kind of tippy-toed around my sermon this morning, which is good because Dwight had just completely stepped on one before. Like, I had to go home and just start over. So I was sitting here going, man, if this happens again, like, I'm just going to have to preach on Sunday morning moving forward. Like, this is ridiculous. So fortunately, he kind of walked around it instead of just jumping on it. So thank you. Are our surroundings Christ-like? I recently watched a video where a young lady, 21, 22, 23, fresh out of college, had the opportunity to sit down with a successful businessman and ask, so what should I do next? And he started asking her, he said, well, where are you at? What are you doing? What's going on? And she starts talking to him about her life and where she's at. And her friends group comes up. And he said, so what's going on? And she said, well, I mean, we're all young and we're still kind of in that college party mode and nobody's really taking their career seriously and we don't work that hard and, you know, I mean, we're young and we're figuring it out. And I think the advice he gave her kind of struck her as odd because it was delivered extremely harsh, but it was sound advice. He said, the best advice I can give you is whenever you leave here, go home and dump your loser friends who aren't going anywhere. Surround yourself with people who have ambition and drive, or you're going to wake up one day, be 30 years old, and be stuck in the same spot with the same people doing the same things and going nowhere. The delivery was a little harsh. Like, he could have done it nicer. But it's not exactly terrible advice. And it's not exactly a new idea. Maybe a brutal delivery, but not a foreign concept. 1 Corinthians 15:33 says, do not be deceived. Evil company corrupts good habits. We see Job had some friends he probably should have gotten rid of. And then we get to Jesus. And we haven't done just a ton of page turning tonight, but I do want us to turn over to John, the 15th chapter, and do some reading here. And then once we're done reading, we're going to kind of pull out some of the big things that I think we can apply here. John, the 15th chapter, and we'll start in verse 9 and go through verse 17. And it says, as the Father loved me, I also have loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. These things I have spoken to you, that my joy may remain in you, and that your joy may be full. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, than to lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do whatever I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for a servant does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you my friends, for all things that I heard from my Father I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit, and that your fruit should remain, that whatever you ask the Father in my name, he may give you. These things I command you, that you love one another. You are my friends. I have chosen you. I picked you. I love you. Love one another. Christ surrounded himself with people that he loved. He surrounded himself with people that challenged him and made him better. Because you think about it, like, some of the people that he's surrounded with, like, Peter probably isn't the easiest guy to get along with all the time. He talks a lot. Sometimes he talks too much. James and John are nicknamed Sons of Thunder. Probably not the easiest guys to get along with. Thomas doubts everything. Like, I don't know how they made that relationship work. But here's the neat thing about these guys. Secular history tells us that all of them died for Christ. All of them died for the cause of Christ. He picked good people. Now, granted, he has the advantage of being a little bit smarter than us, or a lot smarter than us, but he surrounds himself with the right people. He surrounds himself with his people, and he treats them well. He brings them to a knowledge of the things that he knows, and he empowers them to go out and make a change in the world. So we can see here, Christ is aware of his surroundings and who he's surrounded with. So now we arrive back at the original question. Are you like Christ? Can you prove it with your words, your actions, and your surroundings? Does your life resemble the life of Christ? Are you doing everything you can each and every day to be more like him? If you are, that's wonderful. Like, and I know I've said earlier I can come across sarcastic. I hope that doesn't. Like, if you are, like, if you can look at this and look at you and you're good, like, I'm super happy for you. If you're like I was whenever I was putting this together and you go, I could probably do better. Like, there's some stuff in here that I could work on. Like, there's some changes here. There's some stuff that could get fixed here. Then let's do it. Let's be better. Let's don't talk about it. Let's make it all match up. Let's get to work on it. If you're here tonight and you've never obeyed the gospel, then the answer for you is simple. You're not like Christ, but you can be. You have to hear the word. You have to believe. You have to repent. You have to confess and be baptized. And then you have to live faithfully unto death. If you've done these things and the live faithfully part is what's tripping you up, we'd love to help you with that too. We'd love to pray with you and for you. We would love to study together to find examples in the life of Christ for all of us. If we can assist you in any way tonight, we ask that you would come while we stand and while we sing.